This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk to you all about our family's experience with bacteriophage therapy and what that has meant at UC San Diego and beyond. So the title of this presentation is When the Drug is Alive, Treating Superbug Infections with Bacteriophage Therapy. A few disclosures. My husband and I hold stock now in a phage company, which I won't be talking about today, and all patient photos are used with permission. This is a personal story of how my professional and personal lives collided. My husband and I, my husband is a professor of psychiatry at UC San Diego. We went on vacation to Egypt in 2015 around Thanksgiving. He seemed very healthy at the time, although a little bit overweight. You see him crawling backwards down into the Red Pyramid outside of Cairo. We were supposed to see the Valley of the Kings the next day, and he got very ill after a seafood meal on top of our lovely cruise ship. And he ended up in a clinic. There was no hospital. They luckily had a CT scanner, and they scanned him and saw a giant abscess the size of a small football in his abdomen. And they realized that there was a gallstone that had caused this abscess to form. Luckily, we had medevac insurance through the university, and we were able to get him sent first to Germany. And there they put us in an ICU, and you can see that we're in full PPE. Tom was very sick. What they realized that this giant abscess was now home to a superbug infection called Acinetobacter baumannii. It's the number one bacterial threat on the WHO's list of the Dirty Dozen, the most dangerous bacteria that are superbugs that have acquired multi-drug resistance over time. Now, the doctors did what's called an antibiogram, which tells us the antibiotic susceptibility profile of this organism. And even if you don't understand German, you can see that this table has a whole list of R's beside it. That means resistant. It was only partially sensitive to 3 right off the bat. But by the time he was medevaced home to San Diego, it was resistant to even those. So now we had a pan-resistant bacterial infection in an abscess, and he was too weak to operate. So the interventional radiologists put essentially holes in his abdomen to try to siphon out this infected fluid over time. And unfortunately, one of those drains slipped inside him one day, poured all of that infected fluid into his abdomen, into his bloodstream, and he immediately went into septic shock. From that moment, which is now about 4 months after he'd been in the hospital, he was dying a little bit each day. And I was faced with this incredible dilemma because the doctors who were our colleagues at UC San Diego were saying to me, you know, his lungs are failing. That's why he's on a ventilator. His heart is failing. That's why he's on 3 different pressor medications. And now his kidneys are starting to fail. So do you want to start kidney dialysis? And I knew what that meant. That meant essentially, do you want to sustain the life of your husband? And I didn't know what to do. I had power of attorney, but I wanted to know what my husband wanted. Unfortunately, he was in a coma. I didn't know if he could hear me. I asked him, I said, honey, I know you're fighting really hard, but if you want to live, I need you to tell me somehow, maybe if you could just squeeze my hand. Luckily, about a minute later, he squeezed my hand hard, and I was really excited, but I realized, you know, I'm not a medical doctor, so what am I going to do? How am I going to stop this thing? Well, I went home, and I did what anybody would do in my situation. I hit the internet, and I used the National Library of Medicine's search engine called PubMed, and I put in keywords for the name of his superbug, multi-drug resistant, alternative treatments, and up popped something called phage therapy. And I knew what bacteriophage, which is short for phage, I knew what these were. These were viruses that have naturally evolved to attack bacteria. Their activity was first seen in 1896 in India, but it wasn't until 1917 that a French-Canadian self-taught microbiologist named Félix de Harel was able to deduce that whatever this was that could pass through a Pasteur filter had to be smaller than a bacterium, and it could kill bacteria. So he went on and he used this phage to treat bacterial infections, first in 1919 and then throughout other places in Europe. And in fact, the Republic of Georgia opened the first phage center, which is now known as the Ilyava Phage Therapy Center, and they have operated till this day. Now, unfortunately, the fact that now we were approaching World War II and Russia was seen as an enemy put a cloud over phage therapy. And this medicine was seen as Russian and pinko commie science. And this really cast a pall over phage therapy for decades. Now, you might be wondering, okay, how do phage work? Well, this is an electron micrograph of a bacterium stained in orange being attacked by phage, which are stained in green. And they're 100 times smaller than this bacterium, and they attach through a receptor. They enter into the bacterial cell, and if they undergo what's called the lytic phase, they essentially go into phage rage. They make all sorts of baby phages, and when given the kill signal, these baby phages burst out of the bacterium and go on to attack other bacteria that they match to. Now, that's important to realize because phage are very specific. They only attack the bacteria that they're matched to. So I thought this is a great idea. Now, where do you get phages? Well, it turns out that phages are the oldest, most populous organism on the planet. There's 10 million trillion trillion phages that are estimated to be out there. So the best place to find them is actually in sewage. So here's a Petri dish that's streaked with our organism, Acinetobacter baumannii. And if you drop a few drops of sewage on it and you incubate it for 24 to 48 hours, you can see the holes in this Petri dish are a sign that that the phage is matched to that bacteria and is gobbling it up. And so you get very excited, you pluck it out, and you add more bacterial suspension and grow that phage up, and then it can be used to treat animals or people. So I got excited and thinking, could we use phage to treat Tom? Well, I took this photo of Tom that has a t-shirt saying, "I survived Arachibacter." That's the nickname for the organism that he was fighting. And luckily, I had the help of Dr. Chip Schooley and the entire Department of Medicine at UC San Diego, who stood behind me and said, "Yes, if you can find phages that will match Tom's organism, we'll call the FDA and get permission for using it on a compassionate basis." So I sent emails to total strangers, and luckily I heard back from Texas A&M University. Dr. Ryland Young, who's a phage expert, agreed to turn his lab into a command center. He obtained phage from all over the world, and then they found four phages that were a match. Dr. Chip Schooley agreed to oversee the protocol for Tom's treatment. He called the FDA and spoke to Dr. Cara Fiore, expecting he was going to have to explain all about what phage was, but she knew all about it. She said, "You know, the FDA has been looking for a case like this with a patient who's dying and no antibiotic options left, with a physician, a family, and an institution who is willing to take the risk." And so that's how this case happened. But it didn't stop there, because Dr. Fiore put us in touch with the Navy and the Army, who are also working on phage. And long story short, the Navy also found a phage cocktail that would be active against Tom's isolate. And this is important because you can't just have one phage that's going to attack a bacterium, because the resistance that occurs, that is this microbial fight between, you know, the phage and the bacteria, they're duking it out at an invisible level. And the bacteria can become resistant to the phage very quickly if it's only got one phage to attack. So then we had other issues to deal with, because when you're injecting essentially a billion phages per dose into somebody's bloodstream, you need to know, how much phage do you administer? What's the best route of administration? How often should we be doing this, and how long? Dr. Schooley played a really pivotal role in talking to experts to find out what would be the best way to do this. And even in the Republic of Georgia and in Poland, where they've used phage therapy for decades, they generally don't inject it, because there's a potential for endotoxin, which is essentially the leftover remnants of burst bacterial cells that could be toxic to the patient. And nobody knew whether or not this was going to cure him or kill him. Luckily, we had colleagues at San Diego State University who stepped in at the very last minute to reduce the amount of endotoxin to a level that we hoped was safe, but we didn't know for sure. This is what the phage preparation looked like before we administered it to Tom, and you'll see that it has the FDA approval numbers on it, and all of the phages that we use were labeled. This is what Tom looked like the day before we started phage therapy. He had lost 100 pounds. He was not able to be roused at all, and he was thought to be within hours of dying. This is Dr. Schooley and Dr. Randy Taplitz, who administered the phage. They knew that whatever happened, they were making medical history, so they're smiling for the camera, but we were all terrified. And we first administered the phage into the catheters in his abdomen, and when that seemed to not at least cause harm, a few days later we injected the Navy phages into his bloodstream. They were thought to be more virulent. Again, this is a billion phages per dose. And unbelievably, 3 days later, he lifted his head off the pillow and kissed his daughter's hand and began what was a very long but successful recovery. He exited the hospital in August of 2016. And when his case was presented at the 100th anniversary of the discovery of bacteriophage, it went viral in a good way. This story has been covered extensively, both in the medical literature and in the lay press. And we have used phage therapy to treat other patients since then. And Chancellor Khosla at UC San Diego gave us seed funding to start what is the first dedicated phage therapy center in North America called IPATH, the Center for Innovative Phage Applications and Therapeutics. And when we opened, Science Magazine published a commentary saying that this is a game changer in the field. We've treated 12 other patients at UC San Diego since and dozens other internationally with varying degrees of success, but most of them have been successful. And Dr. Schooley and I really published a commentary in Nature Microbiology in May of 2020, really outlining the steps that we think need to be taken next and the issues that involve valency and dose and the synergy that phage can experience when used with antibiotics. We were really delighted that the National Institute of Health funded their first phage therapy trial to the tune of $12 million through the Antibiotic Resistance Leadership Group, and IPATH is going to start enrolling patients in early 2021. Before I close, I did want to touch another case that we've been involved in at IPATH, and this is the first genetically modified phage cocktail to be used successfully in a human case. This was a Mycobacterium abscessus infection. That's a cousin to tuberculosis, and this young girl with cystic fibrosis had a double lung transplant, and this organism was attacking her new lungs. In fact, she was in hospice. She was so close to death, but her mother heard about Tom's case, got the doctors involved. Dr. Schooley also was involved in this. And phage were sourced from a phage library that was obtained through an educational program called Sea Phages at the University of Pittsburgh. And these phages have been essentially crowdsourced by students, and they've been sitting there. Nobody ever thought that they could have therapeutic potential. And some of these phages were matches, but only one was the phage rage kind that undergoes that lytic cycle that kills the bacterial cell. The other two are what I call the kind that enter the bacterial cell and hit the snooze button. And we don't want to use those kind because they actually are called temperate phages. They integrate into the bacterial cell DNA. They can carry toxin genes, antimicrobial resistance genes, and they don't kill the bacterial cell. But that was all that we could find, and we obviously want to use a phage cocktail to reduce the chance of resistance. So what Dr. Hatful did at the University of Pittsburgh was to clip out the repressor gene, forcing these temperate phages to become lytic, the phage rage kind, and now we had the first genetically modified phage cocktail. Luckily, the UK government decided that this was not a GMO because a gene had been taken away, not added, and Isabel received intravenous phage therapy with this genetically modified phage cocktail, and it was successful enough that she left the hospital within a week. This has opened the door for genetically modified phage and synthetic phage that are now the subject of a lot of attention by biotechs and pharmas around the world. So with that, I would like to close and acknowledge the many people that helped not only in my husband's case, but are now collaborators with IPATH. And a global village stepped up to save the life of my husband. And they were total strangers. And it really puts the kind in humankind. My husband and I decided that we would write a book about our story because as an infectious disease epidemiologist, I was blinded by the superbug crisis, and the average person is too. And unfortunately, one person every 3 seconds will be dying from a superbug infection by the year 2050. And so we believe that this is our mission now. And with that, I'll close and I'll answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
So the first thing I wanted to talk a bit more about is this sounds on the face of it just so incredible. It, you know, we've been using antibiotics basically in the beginning of the 20th century. Antibiotics were first really discovered by the 1940s. Many antibiotics were identified, and they seemed to be these magic bullets, which we now know eventually don't work anymore. We get resistant to the antibiotics. So what I'm wondering is, you know, this seems like in some ways, a very different approach to what is possible here. Should we reasonably expect that if we do this right, phage can replace all antibiotics, or is this just another tool in our toolbox?
Well, first, I want to thank you, Mike, and the Center for Ethics in Science and Technology for inviting me to present this evening, and for all of the listeners that have joined in. My colleagues and I at IPATH believe that phage has a rightful place in the repertoire of tools that we will use to attack pathogenic bacteria that are harmful to humans and animals. But we don't think that it's ever going to replace antibiotics entirely. There are people in the phage world that think that that potential is there. In fact, the majority of the cases that we have treated have been in concert with antibiotics. I didn't have time to get into the details, but in my husband's case and in others, we've actually seen that phage, when administered with antibiotics, can be synergistic. So imagine a bacterium being attacked by phage and an antibiotic at the same time. It's forced in a way to make a genetic decision. Obviously, it doesn't have a brain, but the selective pressure from the dual forces that these two agents are pressing upon it means that the survivors are those that often are susceptible to an antibiotic again that it was resistant to recently. So in the case of my husband, it was found that the bacteria that was attacking him, Acinetobacter baumannii, dropped its capsule, which is the slimy layer that is in the bacterial cell wall. That was a virulence factor, but it was also where the receptor for the phage was. So the phage couldn't attack it anymore, but in dropping its capsule, the antibiotic could attack it. So that kind of synergy is really powerful. So even if a phage was to fail in clinical trials, and you know, I'm a scientist like my counterparts at IPATH, and we're leaving an open mind for the data to show us what will manifest itself. But even if phage was to fail in clinical trials, if its sole purpose ends up being to resurrect a failing antibiotic regimen that's been on the shelf because of multi-drug resistance, then that's still a game changer for the field. So we do think that it will have a rightful place. It's thought to be the most important alternative to antibiotics that are out there right now that's worth exploring. And it's going to take some time before the clinical trials are done. And that's where we're entering that era now.
Great. So, yeah, thank you. So I had a bunch of other questions, but a lot of people are asking questions. So I'm going to go to their questions and we'll come back to mine if there's time. So the first one is just a very basic introductory question. So when you say that sewage is a good source of phage, they say what types of matter are included in the meaning of sewage?
Well, that was a little bit of an oversimplification. I think it's important for your listeners to realize that phage are actually everywhere in our environment. As I mentioned, they're the oldest and most populous organism on the planet. There's estimated to be 10 million, 10 million trillion trillion phages. That's 10 to the power of 31 phages on the planet. So our bodies are actually full of phage already. It's just that it wasn't until recently that we had tools like metagenomics and high throughput sequencing to be able to actually see them, or cryo-EM, et cetera. And so you will find phage anywhere. You'll find it in water. You'll find it in feces. You'll find it in soil, and on our skin and other parts of our microbiomes and in animals. But sewage is a great place to find it because we know there's a lot of bacteria in sewage. So I like to tell my husband, you know, humorously now, that he's full of you know what, and we have a nice laugh after he had been through the ordeal that he's been through. But barnyard waste and soil, and even food, rotting food. The young girl that I referred to, her phage was found on a rotting eggplant in South Africa. So it's all a matter of sourcing these phage and putting them into a giant library so that we don't have to go back to environmental sources every time we need them to treat somebody, that we could go to the walk-in freezer and pull out the phage samples that we need and have it ready very quickly.
Yeah, on that count, I mean, my recollection from my pharmacology days was that many of the antibiotics were found by people just going around and looking for sewage outlets and sources. That was a prime target for finding antibiotics, and they could have been looking for bacteriophage as well.
Absolutely. In fact, phage were discovered before penicillin. And many people think that if phage was actually discovered after penicillin, it would still be in wide use today. But we didn't have a lot of the scientific tools that we have now back then, and some of the early science was poor. And then, of course, that geopolitical bias that I mentioned really did play a role in quashing the therapeutic applications of phage, although it has been used extensively in the life sciences. I mean, the discovery of CRISPR, phage display, genetic engineering, cancer biology, all of those were discovered because of phage. But the application of phage to treat people, that was almost lost, except in the East.
Yeah, so there's a question relevant to what you just noted a moment ago about the storage of the phage. So these libraries are frozen, effectively. So they want to know, what that consists of. And part of what I'm wondering, that's a related sort of a corollary question, is how fragile are they? I mean, how long, at what temperature do they have to be kept frozen, and how secure is that? And B, how rapidly do the phage themselves mutate and change so that they may no longer be as effective?
Well, I can talk about this in broad strokes. All of what I've learned about phage is by the seat of my pants. I'm not a virologist. But I do work with Dr. Schooley and Dr. David Pride and others at IPATH. And certainly we know that phage need to be refrigerated. So 4 degrees Celsius is kind of, the temperature that they need to be held at. They can be frozen. Viruses like phage or, SARS-CoV-2, any kind of virus, there's a debate in the field as to whether or not they're really alive. They are kind of inert until they're in the presence of a host, and then magically they kind of jump to life. They're obligate intracellular parasites. So they can be frozen, and they kind of stay in this inertia until they're thawed and then put in the presence of a host. So, and in terms of their mutation, they are multiplying very quickly. So I've been told, my colleagues at SDSU, who are microbial evolution experts, they say that, the life cycle for a typical phage may be around 20 minutes or so. And the burst size, which is the number of phages that burst out of a bacterial cell after they've replicated, is, say 100 to 300 on average. But there's a huge variation. These are incredibly diverse little organisms. And in terms of having a library, what we really need to move this field forward, other than clinical trials, is a giant phage library that would map onto an ever-expanding library of superbugs. Because again, both of these organisms are evolving in real time, and we need to keep up the pace. So we would start, for example, with the escape pathogens. Every letter in escape, ESKAPE, stands for a different superbug. My husband was dying from the A, Acinetobacter baumannii. But those have been prioritized for anti-infectives. Our goal at IPATH is to fundraise to form a phage library that could be used widely, not just for patient use, but also for clinical trials and research, and even to protect us from a bioterrorist event.
Cool. Okay. Well, thank you. So, the next question is one that I was going to ask you about. I was really intrigued by your statement that because a gene was being taken away in Britain, they decided to not classify that as a genetically modified organism. Do you have much insight into what the thinking is here? I mean, it seems that the original idea of genetically modified is you do something with the genes and it's genetically modified, but I don't know.
Right. Well, again, that's a little bit of an oversimplification, and I have to admit, I'm getting this story secondhand. I was, a co-founder of IPATH, but Dr. Schooley was intimately involved in this case and, lending his experience about the protocol for delivering the phage, intravenously into the young girl who received it, and also advising on, the clinical aspects. But I was also told that the UK government was swayed by the argument that these phage that were genetically modified could have evolved to have dropped their repressor gene, and we just helped them along. So on that basis, they decided that they would let this go ahead. We have not seen any adverse effects from phage therapy at all. Even when we're administering it every 2 hours, a billion phages per dose, we were concerned in Tom's case that that we could see septic shock because, again, it's the body is seeing it as an invader. But perhaps because our bodies are so used to seeing phage that they didn't react that way. His white blood cell count spiked for 24 hours and went right back down again. And that's typical of what we see. But no cases of septic shock, to our knowledge, have been recorded.
Great, thank you. So in a time when we are all acutely looking at SARS-CoV-2 and trying to see if we can deal with this through vaccination, somebody asked the question, they didn't specifically mention that virus, but could bacteriophage be harnessed in a way to fight viruses, perhaps by gene editing to target viral receptors?
Well, there is a company that has been working on a vaccine for SARS-CoV-2 that involves phage using phage display, which essentially is a technique. The fellow that developed it won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry 2 years ago. And the phage are used to display or express proteins on its surface that can be used to elicit an immune response. It's not the same as phage therapy. The bacteriophage specifically attack bacteria, not other viruses. But there is a role for phage therapy in the COVID epidemic because many people will be aware that the survivors of COVID are facing a number of other challenges, especially those that have been hospitalized or on a ventilator. And if you're hospitalized and you're very weak and you have, a foreign body like a ventilator inside you, you're more likely to acquire a secondary bacterial infection. We don't know quite yet how common these are, but we've been involved in at least one outbreak of the same pathogen that was affecting my husband, Acinetobacter baumannii, associated with ventilator-acquired pneumonia in a series of regional hospitals in rural Texas. So there is a role for responding to secondary bacterial infections associated with this pandemic, but it's also common for influenza patients to acquire secondary bacterial infections as well. So it's important to realize that, because as we're facing the superbug crisis, these viral pandemics occurring at the same time are leading to more superbug infections, not less. So we're really up against the wall. This is the next real pandemic that has been kind of creeping along, as opposed to COVID that burst on the scene.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. So, and by the way, a question coming up is, what is the ethical dilemma? And just for the record, right now we're first sort of laying a foundation in terms of what the technology is. My philosopher friends tell me, if you want to deal with ethical issues, you have to or with any good philosophical question, you have to first deal with definitions and be clear about what you're talking about. So we're laying that groundwork, and then we can begin answering that question about what some of the ethical challenges might be.
Well, there are a number of ethical challenges that we're already facing at iPath, because people hear about our story and they want phage therapy too. In fact, even if their organism is sensitive to antibiotics, they want it. And the FDA is approving phage therapy only on a case-by-case basis, since it's still considered to be experimental until the clinical trials are done, which is appropriate. However, some patients feel like they should get it no matter what. And so that puts us in kind of a difficult situation, because we have to turn a lot of patients away and say, I'm sorry, you know, you're not eligible for phage therapy under current guidelines. Some of them resort to medical tourism and go, if they can fly, to Poland or the Republic of Georgia to obtain phage there, or to have it imported, where sometimes they receive phage without it being under the supervision of a physician, which we don't recommend. Another ethical dilemma is, should we be using temperate phage in a situation where a patient is dying? The temperate phage are the ones that are the sleepy kind that can carry antimicrobial resistance genes or toxin genes. And if those are the only phage that we can find, some patients would rather have those than no phage at all. But they could cause problems later on. And we still don't know, the extent of what those problems could be. Finally, just like with antibiotics, the use of phage, especially if it's indiscriminate use of phage, could disrupt the microbiome in ways that we haven't anticipated. So I think that the clinical trials are warranted so that we can, study the microbial ecology and the pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics and do the translational studies that we need to establish its role. And as genetically modified phage and synthetic phage are being explored by biotechs and pharmas, that's going to open another element of ethical issues that we will need to address at that time.
Yeah, excellent. And I think we'll come back to several, if not all, of those, so that those ethical issues. I wanted to have you respond a bit to a question about the regulatory environment that we're in. So this person notes that it seems like there are many logistical and or safety barriers. Where do we stand on clinical trials approved by FDA? I know you've got at least one trial going on, but can you address that? And what is the role of biotech or pharma? Do these bacteriophages become proprietary?
So those are interesting questions. So thus far, NIH has approved and funded two clinical trials of phage therapy. There are other funding agencies in Europe and elsewhere that have funded clinical trials. There were some earlier clinical trials, some of which were not designed very well and have had, pitfalls. Because, again, when the drug is alive, people are not able to anticipate things like dose. And so that's been an issue. When it comes to patenting, it's difficult to patent a natural organism, as you can imagine. And a colleague of mine, Dr. Ra Young, who was the one who responded to my email request, he said that the most common phage, phage K, which attacks E. coli, he thinks it's been patented at least 30 times. And so the pharmas and biotechs are a lot more excited about genetically modified phage and synthetic phage, which they believe will be more patentable. But it is possible to patent the route by which you select phage into a phage cocktail. So the way that phages are selected and purified And also the cocktail itself could be patented. So there are biotechs that are working on that angle.
Yes. So there is this interesting idea of what we allow people to patent. So if you have a phage at any given time, as we've discussed, that phage can evolve. And so to what extent, if you believe you have some sort of proprietary ownership of this phage, what does that mean? So it's one thing to say I've got a technology for modifying a phage, say a patent that, but my understanding from what you've said is that at this point there are ways people can effectively patent a particular phage. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, again, this is getting a little bit beyond my own expertise, but certainly that's been attempted, and I think it has been done. But I don't know to what extent it's enforced, because a few little, you know, nucleotides of difference could mean that somebody else could go and patent something almost identical.
That's where it gets really weird. I mean, what does it mean? And so how much variation means that it's still the same thing or it's different? But anyway, so let's take a look at some of the ethical issues you mentioned a bit here and then come back to other questions. So medical tourism. So this is an issue that has come up a lot in the human embryonic stem cell field as well, where there's a new exciting technology. People think, oh, it will cure anything. And then they discover that reputable scientists in this country would say, we don't have something to treat you with yet. We can do research studies to find out whether it works. And then they hear somebody else is doing this in another country. And so there, part of it is, you know, it's probably not that difficult an ethical question to say, is it right for somebody to say they have something that works that doesn't? I think we can agree that, I hope everybody can agree that if you don't have the evidence, then you shouldn't be saying it works. But what are the responsibilities here of scientists in this country to temper enthusiasm? What do you do when you talk to people about bacteriophage and that you have this wonderful success story, but you have to say that doesn't mean it's going to work with everything, with everybody? It may not be ready for prime time.
Sure. Well, at IPATH, I have the luxury of having a whole cadre of physicians that are behind me so that when questions come up from patients or providers and they're clinical in nature, I let them handle those. But with the provisos that people understand that I'm not a physician, but generally our view on this has been that we are careful. We don't recommend that that patients go to receive treatment that wouldn't be approved in the United States, and that especially in cases where crude phage lysate is being used. My husband and the other cases that we've treated them intravenously. That's because we have done, sterility assays and endotoxin assessments so that we know what endotoxin is in the preparation. But in countries that don't have the facilities to be able to do that, if a patient is going and demanding that they receive intravenous phage therapy and they receive it, but they're not aware of the potential dangers, then they could have an adverse event. So that's something to consider. I don't know that that's been a very common occurrence. I've heard of patients that have had good experiences with the medical tourism experience, but we're very cautious in how we talk about it, because we cannot have their phages imported here and just used. They would need to undergo the same amount of rigor that the FDA requires of the phages that we source here.
Yeah. So maybe we could, you know, this is a much more a personal question than a scientific question. But, in the case for your husband, the two of you made a decision to try something. And most people would look at that and say his prognosis was very bleak and there really was no alternative. So some people say, what have I got to lose? How do you answer now somebody who says, well, you chose to do this even though there was no tested, proved answer to this question for your husband, and you tried it in the hope that it would work. Why shouldn't they?
Right. Well, I mean, when I'm contacted by patients or providers that are seeking phage for themselves or someone else, you know, I do tell them that we have a process that we have to go by because the FDA in this country has to approve it on a case-by-case basis. And if they meet those criteria, then we try to find phage for them. And, you know, up until recently, labs have been doing that for free. And we're getting so many requests now, they'll probably have to charge at least for the costs of actually sourcing the phage and purifying it, which also is another ethical concern, because these are emergency investigation, no new drug approvals. That, and so you can't really be charging for something that's experimental. But in terms of the cost of actually sourcing the phage and getting it ready, that's a bit of a gray area that we're encountering right now. In terms of, you know, someone who is ambulatory and doesn't have a life, you know, and death situation upon them right now, it's a different kettle of fish, because they can't just get indiscriminate phage therapy right now. The FDA is considering broadening their approvals on a case-by-case basis. We can also put in IND requests where it isn't an emergency, but they do require a higher bar in terms of the level of safety data that they want to see before they approve that. We haven't been turned down for a case yet, but as you can see, since we've only treated 12 patients thus far in the last couple of years, it's a long process at times to find phage and to get it ready for people. But that's why we want to have a phage library where we could do this much more quickly.
Yeah, actually, since you touched on the expense question, and I think at least one question was looking at that a bit here too. I've heard about this issue a lot with attempts to, for example, do the necessary sequencing to identify which, you know, a cancer tumor, to decide what it might be susceptible to in terms of treatment. And if you discover that a breast cancer, for example, is susceptible to treatment that would normally be approved and used for colon cancer, it may be difficult to get insurance coverage for that. That's my understanding. I don't know if that's always still the case, but you have a similar issue here where somebody may say, nothing else has worked for me. I would like to go this phage route. And somebody, you know, in your case, you were fortunate to have the connections, numerous connections, as you quite freely told us, that not everybody has. And if somebody wanted that, who would pay for that? Would an insurance company pay for it? And I'm guessing the answer is no. But any thoughts on that ethical challenge?
Well, right now, because phage therapy is experimental in the U.S., they're not being charged for the treatment per se, but the healthcare that the patient receives around that is being covered by health insurance at this point, to the best of my knowledge. There are some out-of-pocket expenses that some patients might have experienced, but we haven't been charging patients.
Yeah. So part of what you were talking about is that one of the worries, one of the downsides of indiscriminately treating people with phage is the same thing with antibiotics, possible resistance. And you also mentioned that there are maybe some unknown problems beyond that. I presume you mean maybe effects on other components of the microbiome, or what are some of the unknown effects that we might need to worry about?
Well, if we start with antibiotics and we think of what we know now, is that if you take a broad spectrum antibiotic, it's not just killing the pathogen that you want to kill. It's affecting the other bacteria, the friendly bacteria in our microbiome. And we know now that that could be damaging and have long-term consequences to our immune systems and maybe to other diseases. And with phage, it's a bit of an open question at this point. The good news is they're very specific, and they only attack the bacteria that they're a match to, so that they don't attack other bacteria that don't have that receptor. So in that sense, they're self-limiting, and they're actually removed by the liver and the spleen as part of the reticuloendothelial system. So there's a filter that once they've done their job, they just disappear. So they only are present if there's bacteria that they match to. But there are people that say, well, if somebody is going to take an off-the-counter phage preparation, because those are available, at least in the former Soviet Union and parts of Eastern Europe, and they don't know whether or not it will actually kill what they've got. There's products called intestophage, for example, and other types of products. And if they just take that, it may not cause any harm to them, at least on the surface, but it may be disrupting their microbiome in ways that they don't know. And it may not be matching the bacteria that they're trying to kill anyway. So there's a lot of this potential for self-medication because in the Republic of Georgia and in Poland, phage therapy is considered like the status quo. It's part of their healthcare system. They would never do clinical trials now because they believe that it works. So that's kind of the realm of difference between the East and the West right now, where the East has a lot of clinical experience and they have wonderful phage libraries. We're holding it to a higher standard here in the U.S. and in Western Europe because we haven't been convinced that phage therapy holds enough of a candle to antibiotics. And so both of those scenarios exist in this world right now. And that's why patients are frustrated because they say, well, you know, if I could get this in Poland, why can't I get this here? And I understand that. I mean, I've been on that end of it as well. My husband couldn't have flown, even if he wanted to, at that point in time.
Yeah, I mean, well, this is not just for your case, but for many cases, especially parents with children who might be suffering from some illness that may be fatal. And you understand that they're going to be willing to try anything.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons that I've become such an advocate. I mean, I've been working hard along with my husband, not just to tell our story and to make people aware of superbugs and phage therapy, but to move this into clinical trials and to also have legislation like the Pasteur Act, which is before Congress right now, that would help accelerate other anti-infectives in the pipeline, as well as new antibiotics, which are much needed because by the year 2050, one person every 3 seconds is going to be dying from a superbug infection. That the horse is already out of the barn and there's very, very few antibiotics in the pipeline.
Yes, yeah, so the hope is that bacteriophage will work well enough and for long enough that we won't have to, that the resistance issue won't become a factor. But it seems that we hope that for antibiotics too. So what do we need to do?
I don't think that's the case. What we've learned with antibiotics and with phage, even in my husband's case, resistance did occur. We have to anticipate that resistance is going to occur because the bacteria have their own immune systems. CRISPRs are part of that. The phage have their anti-CRISPRs. They really are using our own bodies as their own military theater to carry out their, you know, 4 billion long fight against one another. So what the phage library that I've been advocating for would do would allow us to go back to the phage library after, you know, a bacterial mutant has arisen as a result of phage therapy and source a new phage cocktail. And that was done with my husband's case on the fly. And that's why the Navy was so excited, because that proved to them that their strategy around personalized phage therapy on demand could occur. And so if we have a large enough phage library, then we should be able to source additional phage when needed to keep up with any bacterial mutants that emerge.
So probably moving on to the question of who should get the therapy and at this stage when it's experimental. You've probably given a fair bit of thought to this. I mean, if you deal with somebody who is terminally ill, you could say, why not? Nothing else will work. But on the other hand, because of this stage of illness that they have, the risk of, or the possibility of success may be lower than if you had dealt with them before they were in such dire straits. So I see this sort of tension between trying to treat people who are going to be just multifactorial versions of illness and very difficult to sort out whether you're actually succeeding or not, as opposed to treating people who are not in such dire straits, but is it right to be treating them with a completely different treatment when we already have other approaches that might be used? So how are you wrestling with that?
That's very true, especially because as people's antibiotic options start to dry up, the antibiotics that are left are generally the more toxic ones. So colistin, the last resort antibiotic that was used in my husband's case, that's a World War II antibiotic that is nephrotoxic. It's very toxic to the kidneys. But some patients are being told that they have to use it because that's still in the armament of modern medicine. And so if a patient, however, has a severe allergic reaction to an antibiotic, then that will count as, a contraindication. So we've been able to use that as evidence to the FDA to allow them to approve it. But also the INDs rather than the EIND requests are starting to become approved. It's just that they are more labor intensive in terms of the regulatory paperwork. But the number of patients that are waiting for phage therapy is huge. I mean, if we could treat every patient that wanted it since our center opened 2 years ago, it would be in the thousands. So it's not the demand, it's our ability to, maneuver through the regulatory hurdles, but also to source the phage, because we have to rely on collaborating laboratories that are donating their time, because we don't have a centralized repository of phage at this point. I mean, if somebody calls me and says, I've got a chronic urinary tract infection with Klebsiella pneumonia that's multi-drug resistant, I go, okay, I know I can contact Baylor, Texas A&M, and maybe Walter Reed. You know, if it's an unusual pathogen, I've been known to go to Twitter to crowdsource it. So you do what you have to do. And I'm grateful and happy that we've been able to help more patients than not. But we have a long way to go, and that's why we are advocating as strongly as we are for more support to be able to help more patients.
Yeah, the more I'm thinking about this and talking to you, the more I realize that we have this possible new therapy, and it sounds promising and maybe a really useful avenue for some people. Are you the only organization that is, it sounds like you're effectively a clearinghouse, the place that people can go. Are you the only place they might go for this?
Well, we were in the beginning, at least in the U.S., other than Yale. Yale University has been, treating patients on a case-by-case basis and was involved in a case around the same time as my husband. And we collaborate together as well. But since IPATH formed, Baylor University has a program now called Taylor. The Mayo Clinic has a program for prosthetic joint infections, because anybody with hardware like a prosthetic knee or a prosthetic hip or pacemaker wires or LVAD devices, those tend to get these biofilms, which are this slimy layer that I likened to the microbial version of the Borg, that antibiotics are very hard to penetrate. And so there are doctors that specialize in those kinds of infections. And we've been successful in using phage therapy to get those phage to penetrate those biofilm layers. So those are just a couple of the teams that have formed. And there's also a number of biotechs that we regularly reach out to as well.
So I think we probably should wrap things up, but this has been fascinating. I mean, I think it's a really exciting new area. And as I said at the beginning, this is a topic we haven't covered before, but what we're learning today is we haven't covered it before because people haven't been talking about this enough. And it's still, tune you. And so really appreciate your time to be able to share this with us. And I appreciate the many questions from the audience to be able to look at these issues. So I want to thank everybody for this evening.
Well, I want to thank you too. And I also want to thank UC San Diego. If it wasn't for, you know, being at a cutting edge university and hospital system that was willing to take a risk on, you know, what seemed like what one doctor referred to as a Hail Mary pass in the last minute of the game when the quarterback is blindfolded, throwing the football down 100 yards and hoping that somebody's going to catch it. Well, somebody did. And that made a difference, not in just my husband's life, but many, many, many other lives and maybe millions of lives. It's been described as, you know, a turning point in medicine. And my husband and I feel really privileged that not just that we're part of UCSD and this was to happen, but we realize because we are privileged being in a country with resources, and the majority of people with superbug infections are dying in lower and middle income countries. And so by telling our story and making people more aware about that, we feel that this is the reason we're on the planet, that this happened to us for a reason, and we're willing to pay it forward to see that, you know, maybe we'll be able to save more lives.
Yeah. Well, thank you. It's been an inspiration. Have a good evening.
Thank you very much, Mike.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.